Greetings, fellow a-holes. You have reached Objection, the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery, as hosted by DVDverdict.com and underwritten by a very generous grin from the old white cabal. Right, Dan Mancini?
Very generous.
I mean, really, more than we asked for a large amount, but they really came through.
You know? They did. I was worried about my kids not being able to go to college and... you know, as long as they have some sort of major in evil, I think they'll be covered.
Yeah, absolutely. Like some kind of geopolitical warfare concentration, right. Perhaps. And if you want to learn more.
You know.
If you want to learn more.
Minor in oppression, something
that's
like
right,
that.
Major in oppression, you know, deforestation, perhaps, I think.
Yes.
And, of course, if you want to learn more about White Man Cabal, please check them out at their own Facebook page, facebook.com/oldwhitemen. So
yes,
got enough followers for their own custody order. But we are continuing our countdown of action movies despised by Prius enthusiasts. Gross generalization, but we don't care. We are contrarian a-holes, and we brought a third a-hole with us. Though he seems like a pretty nice guy, so maybe we're not. Maybe we should be so quick to lump him in.
I try to be.
With degenerates like ourselves. And that is Mr. Clark Douglas. How's it going, Clark?
Going quite well. How about yourselves?
Not too bad. And you, Clark, is, of course, the brains and lips behind the Sights and Sounds of Cinema, the excellent, well-pursued podcast that runs, I think, right after ours, right? I mean, I think...
It is, on Tuesdays.
It's Tuesday, yeah. So... we kind of open for you. That's the way we look at things, right, Dan?
Yeah.
We're the opening act. So
I think well pursued may be my best review yet. So.
Oh, good. I think it's not even a real word. So there you go. You know, because we've got you, you're a captive audience, Clark. We'll kind of roll this into a recap of the Prius enthusiast action movie as loathed by countdown. I thought that you, since your specialty. Is soundtracks and scores.
Okay.
Maybe when I do this countdown, if you recall them, maybe you could chime in with a quick reaction to the scores of these films.
Sure.
What do you say? Dan, how's that sound?
I think that sounds great.
I know it's not covered in the grant. I know it's not totally covered.
No.
But this would be a good way for us to recap anyway. So we're doing 20 of these, and number 20 was Band of Brothers.
So really great score by Michael Kamen. On that one. Actually, I think one of his very best works, kind of reminiscent of John Williams' music for Saving Private Ryan in spots, but a really, really excellent score.
Do you think I'm directly influenced by that? I mean, obviously Spielberg was involved. Was there any kind of influence, you know?
It's a possibility. I mean, I think they were going for a similar sort of musical tone. I don't think it steals any actual, you know, melodies or anything too explicit, but... again, that score, television scoring at its finest, as far as I'm concerned.
And Michael Kamen's typically a feature film guy, right?
He is, or he was. He passed away a few years ago.
Gotcha. Okay, number 19, obviously a well-known one, but Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom. Does this have any there's obviously some difference. There's some big differences, obviously. I mean, the iconic Indiana Jones score is there, but where does Temple of Doom rank in the four films?
That would actually be my second favorite of the four. I do think Raiders of the Lost Ark is the best of the four scores, but Temple of Doom has a lot of great ideas, and that was actually a soundtrack that it took me a long time to track down because it was out of print for the longest time, and the only version that was available was this Japanese imported CD, and only recently did they get around to doing a proper American release of that. But a great score by John Williams.
Nice. Number 18 probably speaks for itself, but I'll let you throw your two cents in. That's, of course, the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, yeah. Tremendous. I mean, that's been analyzed to death. I think there's actually a book coming out. It just came out, or it's about to come out, exclusively about the music from the Lord of the Rings movies. But, yeah, great stuff.
Okay, this one might be tough. So this is esoteric, but if you can pull this off, my respect for you goes up many notches. Number 17, Commando.
I believe James Horner did that one, and if I'm also not mistaken, it's been a while since I've listened to it, but it's very synthy, more so than most of James Horner's stuff.
I think that's true, yeah.
But I seem to recall it being kind of cheesily entertaining.
Much like the film, I would say.
Sure, yes.
Number 16, another odd duck here, but Black Dynamite.
I haven't heard the soundtrack or seen the movie, sadly. I've wanted to, but no, I can't comment.
Okay, we'll give that a pass, but that is a film you would benefit yourself greatly from checking out. Number 15, which was the last one we left off with, True Lies, James Cameron's True Lies.
Not really a fan of that score. I've never really been a big fan of Brad Fidel in general. I never even really liked his Terminator soundtracks, to be honest. It's just... I don't know, this really, really simplistic synthesizer stuff that's dated very badly. True Lies a little less so than the Terminator movies, I think, but
right.
I don't know. I'm not really a fan of that one.
Nothing, I can't even, I mean, I recall the sense of True Lies, like, I just, as in generic action score.
Yeah.
You know,
I will say, you know, to the Terminator score's credit, they're at least memorable, if
right.
not always positively so.
Yeah. Yes. All right. Very good. Thank you for playing along, Clark. Well done.
My pleasure.
So let's just go continue our content. We got another two movies, 14 and 13. And again, Dan, I'll let you pop in here. What's the criteria as dictated by the grant for inclusion in this list?
As dictated by the grant, it would be movies that have true action heroes. They're not passive. They are active. They take the initiative. Movies that do not paint the old white man cabal as the bad guy.
In a poor light, yes. I believe that was statute number 3.
Yes.
I mean, that's some examples, one. Of course, would be like the Bourne Identity, perhaps.
Yes. Or, yeah. That would fail
every
the OWMC test.
That's right.
Movies that posit that communism is evil would be in there. What are some of the other ones?
Well, it's just that. It's one of those things, you know it when you see it, you know? So, I mean, I think, again, heroes who aren't mopey little weenies, you know, not a ton of nuance. Not saying that there's not a place for nuance, but just kind of the sirloin heroes, you know, just the red meat chewing, butt kickers just go out and take care of business and don't really care about other people's feelings. I suppose that might be.
Male confidence, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and again, yeah. Well, the genesis of this countdown is a conversation Dan and I had. Just when you look at who are the biggest idiots, as dictated by commercials and sitcoms, and that is a father or a husband. They are.
Yes.
They can't get out of their own way if they're changing a light bulb or mounting a new tire. It'll end in like loss of limb. So
yeah.
This is it's not awful. There is such a thing as a functional.
It's progressive stupidity because, husbands are, borderline zero intelligence, and then the only way you can be stupider than a husband is to be a father also.
That's right.
Because, not only are you stupider than your wife, but you're stupider than, your 8-year-old kid.
So Clark, does that make sense? It's not too late to back out now.
No, absolutely.
All right. So. All right, Trooper, welcome. Welcome to the conclave of a-holes here. So I guess we will start off with number 14, which is something we've talked about before in former objection episodes, Dan.
Yes.
But it's a James Bond film, the only James Bond film on this list. And it's probably still my favorite, even though and it's not Casino Royale, even though I like Casino Royale, and they were moving in a pretty good direction with Bond there. He wasn't really, he wasn't a wuss at all. Though I like to think that characterization was, certainly paid. We certainly saw elements of that in this movie. And that is Timothy Dalton's License to Kill.
Yes.
One of the more violent PG-13 movies, flat out, you will ever see.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true.
So Clark, we'll let you kind of break the ice here. License to Kill, what are your thoughts, and how would you see this fitting in on the list?
I've always very much enjoyed License to Kill, and I think, to me, it's, I wouldn't call it my favorite Bond film. At the very least, the best Bond movie of the 1980s, and one that I've always seen as kind of refreshing in that it was one of the few Bond movies, like Casino Royale and like On Her Majesty's Secret Service to an extent that was willing to allow the character to evolve a little bit and go new places and step outside the traditional Bond formula.
Which at that point included clown makeup and space lasers.
Yes. Right.
Exactly. And I think they were trying to go for a similar sort of tone with Timothy Dalton's first Bond outing, but
right.
that one just didn't quite gel for me.
The Living Daylights,
as a movie, but everything they were kind of struggling with in that one, they got right in License to Kill, and it's a shame that it wasn't able to continue on with Timothy Dalton after that.
Dan, how about your thoughts on License to Kill?
Again, like you said, one of the more violent PG movies, maybe ever. I watched it today in preparation.
Oh, well done.
Yeah.
That's like the most amount of show prep we've ever done.
Yeah.
Show ever.
And, you know, you got the guy exploding in the...
oh, in the decompressor tank. Yeah. T-Bag from the Young Rider.
Yeah, and that's very bloody, that explosion.
It upset me when I was watching, you know, however old I was. It kind of really upset me a little bit, you know, because it seemed so painful, you know.
Yeah, and Dalton is great in it, as we've discussed in the past. You know, he is sort of the classic hero. Definitely takes it to the bad guys, with good reason in this film. You know, I think the movie does a good job of, you know, giving Bond a reason to be angry, to be emotionally involved in the story.
Yeah, to be all
very often mm-hmm. he's not. Usually he's completely cold, and he's just businesslike and in License to Kill it to, you know, paraphrase Jaws 3 or whatever, Jaws Revenge, this time it's personal. It's definitely the case in License to Kill.
And you know, and this
just does a great job.
And this isn't my original thought. I remember reading this somewhere, so I can't claim it as my own, but you know, License to Kill was interesting because he wasn't fighting against someone who was like trying to take over the world or anything. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't a Hugo Drax plot, which currently is my favorite James Bond megalomaniacal plot. But, you know, it wasn't like the world was at stake. You know, he was going after a powerful Colombian drug lord. You know, so there's no lasers. There were no GoldenEye lasers, nothing like that. So it was kind of a mano-a-mano thing. And when you talk about him being active and really – I mean, he – usually you see a lot of our heroes, again, when we talk about heroes being passive, a lot of the times when you see like the final bad guy fight, right? It's usually the bad guy's been subdued, everyone relaxes, then he pulls a gun out of his holster and like some sniper shoots him from 20, you know, 200 feet away, and that's how the bad guy dies. You know, that mm-hmm. it's rare that the hero is the number one agent complicit in the bad guy's death. You know, this, I mean, everyone who dies at his hands, he's the one who can be pinned for the murder, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he drops that guy into the shark tank after he got information, you know, while the guy was helpless, dropped him in the shark tank,
yeah.
tossed a hapless security guard to a drawer of maggots, which is still a... I think Freddy Krueger would go to the depths of depression. So just, got, you know, shot the guy with a harpoon gun, point blank,
yeah.
with no exit strategy, shot him and jumped in the water. He's just all id. That's what he is. All
id. And another interesting element of that is that in License to Kill, there's no pretense of doing this for Queen and Country. It's all purely revenge and murder, basically.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's really no higher calling for this than just his best friend and his best friend's wife got screwed over royally. You know, someone's got to pay. Plus, you just gotta love the late '80s, you know, the cocaine and you know, and the drug dealer.
Yeah,
you know, again, the violence, Benicio del Toro getting fed through a cocaine grinder. I mean, really, feet first.
That was the moment that always kind of traumatized me as a kid when I was watching this movie.
That's right.
the cocaine grinder.
Yeah. That was feet first, no less. Slowly, you know.
I always wondered, you know. Does that piece of heavy machinery have a different purpose, or does somebody actually manufacture a cocaine grinder?
Is it like the cotton gin? You know?
Right.
Are you like Whitney behind the technology? Cocaine gin. And, you know, the other thing, I mean, like, Bond isn't, like, doesn't have any, I mean, he's got, like, one one-liner, I thought, like, when that one guy got impaled by the forklift, which took a lot of effort on the bad guy's part, you know, but he's, you know, came to a dead end, I think. But I think that was, like, the only one-liner I could remember. So he wasn't, like, reeling off these smart-ass one-liners. He wasn't interested in banging every girl he saw, you know? It was like he was focused on a mission that he needed to accomplish it, point A to point B, you know?
And he I mean, there's no way that Roger Moore could have fed a guy to a shark and not had a smarmy one-liner immediately after it. But does not, so far as I remember. You know, he just kind of cold-bloodedly feeds the guy to the shark. And
the most striking one-liner in that movie for me was always the one the villain had after that guy blew up and the money's covered in blood, and they said, "What do you want us to do with it?" And he said, "Launder it."
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, Robert Davey, another classic 80s icon guy, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, quite a big step from his stint as a villain in The Goonies, for sure. But
yes.
And plus it ends with that great, I'm a sucker for truck chase scenes, you know, and this doesn't, I mean, I suppose a Prius enthusiast would hate a gas tanker chase scene, right? You know, especially when so many of them blow up and just belch out carbon into the atmosphere. But, you know, I mean, I love truck chase scenes, and that was a great one, even though he pops a wheelie. But I forgive the pop a wheelie mainly because they actually built a semi that pops a wheelie. If you look at it in the extras, they built one. So I'm willing to let that slide because for some reason, they felt compelled to do that. So,
and I do love that during that sequence that they find time to include a few shots that very distinctly and intentionally, I'm pretty sure, recall North by Northwest.
Oh, yeah, and, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It looks very cool.
That's right. And they're immediately followed by shots of you know, Colombian drug dealers flying over a cliff in a flaming jeep.
No, they don't last long.
Jeep. Yeah.
I've also always loved the fact that, I mean, these are true men's men because, you know this because at the beginning, they're going to a wedding. They get sidelined to take down this drug dealer. They go get into a big shootout and stuff, and yet they're able to show up at the wedding. Their tuxes are okay.
Like total studs.
They're clean.
They come out like total studs.
Right. You know? They look perfect, you know, no hair out of place, go through with the wedding, finish it off, and move on.
Absolutely. So, License Skill, man. I'm jealous of you, Dan, for having watched it already. I need to end this podcast now and go watch it. But we got to move on. So that is our number 15, I guess. I can't remember.
14.
So let's go on with 13, and this is like a personal favorite of mine, one of my favorite movies of recent years. I don't know if it's underrated or overrated, to tell you the truth, but for some reason, it just really, it just really floated my boat, and that is Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. So
yes.
I will let you guys begin because I don't want to drone on and on right off the bat, but Clark, I'll let you start this again. Apocalypto, what are your thoughts about this, you know, nice piece of Mayan kickassery?
To me, it's easily Mel Gibson's best film as a director.
Totally agree.
I was one of the people, I like Braveheart, but I don't know. I always felt it was kind of overrated. It never really achieved greatness for me. And again, Passion of the Christ, an interesting film, but didn't entirely work for me. Apocalypto, though, just an incredible piece of filmmaking on a technical level. I don't think many films have been as adept at handling action in recent years. And Gibson's direction of the action sequences, particularly in the final hour or so.
Which is essentially one extended action sequence.
Basically, just incredible. I remember the first time I saw that in the theater, my jaw was pretty much hanging open for the final hour or so of that movie. Just incredible.
Absolutely. Dan?
I would agree with all of that. It doesn't, as far as the offending Prius owners, it definitely does not past the all civilizations are created equal.
Right, the noble test. Savage kind of goes out the window here.
Yes, it does not pass that. Although, you know, it doesn't, I think some of the criticism of it on that level was kind of wrong-headed. I think some people came away with the wrong wrong message or wanted to attribute the wrong message, probably because Gibson directed it. Because I don't think it was a slam on that culture so much as it was on just human nature.
Right.
And the fact that we do have a tendency to devolve into corruption.
Mm-hmm. Especially
with power and, you know.
And when a civilization is most susceptible, you know, to takeover when it decays from within. That's one thing I guess.
Right.
You know.
I mean, had Oliver Stone directed that movie, then people would have read it as, you know, an allegory of today.
It's called Avatar. That's what I'm going to
call it. Right. Exactly. But it's just a great, you know, like Clark said, a technically really good, movie in terms of the its sense of pacing is pretty amazing. Because, man, once it gets going, and it gets mm-hmm. going pretty early on, it just does not let up.
Right.
I will say that it takes a little bit to get going for me. Like the first, I guess, 15 or 20 minutes comes across a little awkward to me. Like Mel Gibson is trying to do Jackass Mayan Civilization Edition or something for a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah, pranks. Yeah,
right. But I guess once the central story kicks in, it doesn't let up or make many mistakes from there.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I mean, even when, like, to me, some of the most compelling stuff in the film is the long trek while, you know, they're captured. Their long trek while they're captured, you know? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it really develops the character. I mean, you really get invested in the characters, both, you know, good and bad. Even though they're not speaking a word of English, you know?
Yeah.
You really kind of – and, you know, they're all adorned in these, you know, unbelievable, you know, costuming and such. But you really get a sense of, you know, who these guys are. And then the payoff – and then, you know, that's mirrored, obviously, by that primal male desire to protect, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So the wife, the pregnant wife and the child are, you know, in the well. I mean, and she's not like, you know, she's not a helpless, you know, little person either. You know, she's surviving, you know, in her predictment, though, you know, she's still, you know, she needs to get out of the well somehow. So he's got that drive. And I think that's certainly a very, you know, the dad quality, I suppose, the husband quality, that male, you know, getting back and protecting and saving. So, like, so you got all that investment, and it just kind of really builds up. And of course, the dynamite human sacrifice scene, which is ridiculously tense. You know, it is ridiculously tense. I mean, I didn't know how it was going to resolve at all. You know, yeah, I knew it had to, right? I mean, the movie was only halfway over, something that so.
Mm-hmm.
So then just from that point on when they're being hunted, I just, you know, when Jaguar Paw, you know, turned the tables on those guys, you know, took off, and then you saw those guys just look out into the cornfield or whatever, I was like, oh boy, here we go. And it was just nothing but a series of just awesome payoffs one after the other.
Yeah.
You know?
And it was really, you know, the villains, the aside from the priests who were insane.
Right.
But the warrior villains, you know, you had a couple of real douchebags, but like the main guy.
Yeah, it was just a dad.
You almost had a respect for the guy.
Right.
Yeah. Because
he was badass.
You understood where he was coming
from,
which makes him,
you know,
more compelling as a bad guy, too.
Right. And there did seem to be something honorable about the guy, you know. Despite the fact that he was the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, sacrificing humans and all that.
My favorite moment was
sold out to his, you know, to his civilization.
Right. He was capturing his own, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that decay point, you know. It was like they were just kind of, you know, the civilization had kind of turned in on itself,
mm-hmm.
started feeding on its own, which, again, I thought, you know, it's a compelling study of human nature, you know. It's not, it's just, you know, human beings are human beings, and everyone's, you know, susceptible to this kind of corruption.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, man is capable of atrocities to fellow man no matter what.
Yeah. And I do think there's a lot of interesting ideas in there in regards to that, but I think it's been, as Dan mentioned earlier, disappointing the way that a lot of critics have read into the subtext of that movie. Basically, projecting all of these things onto it that have nothing to do with the movie and everything to do with Mel Gibson's personal problems.
Right, right.
It can be a little frustrating.
Absolutely. I can't finish the discussion of Apocalypto without mentioning the Jaguar attack, right?
Yes.
Yikes. I was prepared for the worst in this movie, and maybe I'm just a desensitized a-hole, but it wasn't like the relentless violence I thought it would be, although the Jaguar attack was flirting with nuttiness for sure.
Yeah.
You know, but I didn't think it was like the – because that's one thing I read every – you know, so violent, so violent, so violent, you know? And I think – I'm wondering if that's a theme that's rung a lot by Gibson critics, you know? It's just like, mm-hmm. Oh, so violent, you know? I mean, I was expecting like Faces of Death 5 or something, and it just – it was violent. I'm not taking that away, and it's not a movie to show the kindergartners for sure. But I wonder if that aspect was kind of overhyped to the film's detriment.
Well, perhaps yeah. So, especially coming in the wake of The Passion of the Christ, you know, which came right. under so much criticism for being violent all the way right. through. And, yeah, I do think that element was overhyped. I mean, you're right; it is a violent movie, but not gratuitously so, and not
yeah, maybe
so
the Jaguar.
Any other action?
Only thing I could think of that might be pushing it a little bit, but it wasn't. You know, nothing else seemed to me to be so over the top. I mean,
speaking of which, do Toyota Prius owners approve of Jaguars being beaten to death in film?
Oh, good question.
Yeah,
and not prayed to and thanked for their
probably not.
Not a whole lot going on in the man-animal relationship.
Not at all. Not a symbiotic relationship. And again, we'd be we have to mention that I believe this is documentation of the first appearance of the old white man cabal, right, Dan? I think at the very end.
Yes. Yes.
That's true.
I believe they show up for the first time. They're ready to rock and roll. So. Oh, man. All right. Well, you know, man, I think that brings us to the end of this countdown. So big thanks to Clark. Clark, thanks for stopping. Actually, let me ask you this. The score of Apocalypto.
Very interesting score. Another one by James Horner. And, again, another different one for him because it's not really focused on his usual melodies and memorable themes so much as a lot of sound design and grunting noises and percussion and strikingly different from really most film scores I've heard. A very unique work.
And because essentially that whole hour at the end is dialogue free,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's so much, you know, and obviously the on-screen action is engrossing, but that score pushes a lot of the action as well.
It really does.
That's pretty
it
much
carries,
audio, you know?
Yeah, a good section of that movie.
All right, so Apocalypto and License to Kill, two of my personal favorites. And we're getting into we're fast approaching the realm of just full-on a-holery as far as this countdown goes, right, Dan? I mean, it's gonna get pretty tough to endure pretty soon, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, it's going to get – the testosterone levels are going to be pretty,
absolutely.
Pretty off the charts.
Yeah, so just be prepared for that. So So anyway, Clark, thanks again for stopping by. We appreciate your input. These little crossover episodes are always good fun, and we look forward to the next edition of the Sights and Sounds of Cinema, which is on Tuesdays on DVDverdict.com.
Yes, indeed, The Leftovers.
A fantastic podcast. So please check it out, and we'll see you next week, Dan. What else is there to say?
Thanks. 10 points easy. Oh, shit!